So where are we at? We kind of put out there last week what I hoped was would be a little bit of a kind of a game changer in terms of mindset, almost a bit of a bombshell. If it didn't sound particularly bombastic or revolutionary, then I didn't do a good enough job of selling it. So I apologize for that. But essentially, it's a very dramatically different way of looking at biblical prophecies. And it's something I learned from Rav Meidan many years ago from the very first set of classes that I took with him. And it's something which has permeated much of our study, both in terms of my study of Tanakh and what I've learned from him over the years. And that is that the phrase Acharit HaYamim, and this is kind of just a quick review of what we ended with last week, the phrase of Acharit HaYamim, which is ubiquitous to so many prophecies and so many expressions of the Nevi'im. We talk about it will be Acharit HaYamim, and whatever that time frame is, we'll talk about in a moment. And great prophecies of redemption and messianism and the Melech HaMashiach, the restoration of the Beit HaMikdash, the ingathering of the exiles. So many of our foundational prophecies are prefaced with this statement of it will be Acharit HaYamim. And we have early prophecies, such as Yaakov Avinu on his deathbed, who's talking to his children, and he says to them, come gather, I'll tell you what will be Acharit HaYamim. And again, if assuming that this translation is the end of days, then all of these prophecies are kind of this picture of some time in the future in which history will come to its conclusion or its culmination. And it's translated in most instances as the end of days. What we had suggested, and this is the thesis that we're going to kind of pick up on today, is that the word acharit doesn't mean end. It means later. Meaning it's a frame of reference to some point in the future. And it's the opposite of the phrase lefanim b'Yisrael. Lefanim b'Yisrael means in the past. So if lefanim means in the past, then achor means in the future. How far into the future is undefined. It could be tomorrow. It could be the day after tomorrow. It could be a month from now. It could be an epoch from now. It could be millennia from now. Acharit simply means latter, later, sometime in the future. But if that's true, then every one of these prophecies that begins Vayah b'acharit hayamim, it will be in the future. This will be the picture of what we're talking about. And that's part of we got into this because that's part of the conversation between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. Because Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, you are dreaming about what will be b'acharit hayamim. You are dreaming about what will be. Translate. You are dreaming about what will be in the future. Now, how far into the future is the question with a capital T? And that's the question that we're going to try to unravel today, in at least in the code language, meaning step back for a second and ask ourselves a basic foundational question in terms of the study of Bible. How far into the future did the prophets see, did the prophets prophesy? In their intended remarks, in their comments, in their prophecies, in their words, when they spoke them, and they spoke them to an audience, what frame of reference in time were they intending? Now, the question is relevant because we in the study of Tanakh today, in today's generation, are centered and focused around the pursuit of understanding Pshat. We've talked about in various contexts. We had a mini series last year about study of Midrash. The study of Pshat and the study of Midrash operate differently. But in the study of Pshat, which is text, I've translated often as text in context, meaning the Pshat of any particular verse, chapter, or story is how it was understood by both the speaker and the listener. it's not necessarily how it was understood by rabbis and interpreters 100 years later, 500 years later, 1,000 years later. The pshat of pshat is to understand text and context, how it was understood by the people who are listening. And so the people who are listening to Yeshayahu speak about the Beit HaMikdash standing on the tops of mountains and the nations of the world coming and saying, we will go with you and we will come to the temple of God and we will hear the words of Torah and we will listen to the words of Torah. And he prefaces all this by saying, this will be Be'acharit HaYamim. Is Yeshayahu talking about some time in 3,000 years in the future? Or is Yeshayahu talking to his generation and saying, this will be tomorrow, the day after, a month from now, depending on X, Y, and Z? That's the core of the question. And we're going to journey through that question today. And then we'll take it back into the world of Daniel. So I'm going to go back to sharing my screen. I hope everybody has the source pages are in the chat if you want to download them. I'm also going to display them on the screen. So this you should now have as a okay, you should now see the screen in front of you. And this is the source page for today. It looks like this. How far did Daniel see? Okay. So just to go a quick context, we're talking about the Nevuah of Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar sees these this big statue with these four medals, and the Mefarshim are trying to figure out what do these four medals represent and how far into the future does it go. And ultimately, it is Daniel who says to Nebuchadnezzar, what you're seeing is a vision of Acharit HaYamim. And that's the core of our question today. So Chazal have a really interesting statement. And the question here, the Gemara Megillah is talking about a different issue altogether, which is how many prophets were there. We have traditionally identified 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses, but the number is really less significant. The Gemara says there were many prophets who we know existed, but we don't necessarily have a record of their words or their prophecies. And here the Gemara says, Harbei Nevi'im Amdu Lem Yisrael. There were many prophets in Israel over the course of time. Kiflaim ki yatzei Mitzrayim. Double the number of how many Jews left Egypt. It's probably an exaggeration of sorts. But the real question is, so why do we only have 24 books of Tanakh? Why do we only have the words of a specific small set of prophets? Says the Gemara, Nivu'a shu tzrecha ledorot nichteva. V'shelom tzrecha lo nichteva. A prophecy is only written down in Tanakh and recorded for posterity, for in generations to come, if it was needed for generations to come. In other words, there is a decision, there's a collection process, there's a selection process in terms of determining which prophecies were recorded in a book that was then preserved in Tanakh and which were not. And the ones that were recorded were the ones that, for whatever reason, for bad or for good, whether because it's a role model of things, mistakes we made, or whether it's because of a prophecy that will be a lesson to be learned from, or a story we can learn from, or a prophecy that is still to yet be fulfilled. Whatever the context is, it's in Tanakh if we need it to be, because we need to learn from it. But what we need to learn from it may not necessarily be the lesson or the message it was originally articulated for. There were many prophecies that were articulated to a generation, and either they came true or they were not relevant to generations later to come, and therefore they're not recorded. And that essentially begs the question, how far did the prophets see? And I would take this question one step further and ask ourselves, what's the purpose of Nevuah? Yirmiyahu is standing in front of his people 40 years before the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And he's conveying a message. What is the purpose of his message to his people? Yeshayahu is standing in front of his people 100 years prior. And he's talking to them and he's trying to encourage them and he's trying to get them to change their ways and he's trying to inspire them and he's trying to get them to do tshuva. He has a message to them. Well, what's his message? Is his message to them, can I stop sharing for a second? Is his message to them that in another 2,500 years, events X, Y, and Z are going to take place? Is that going to inspire anybody in his generation? Is it going to help anybody in his generation if he were to say, you know what, in 2,000 years, we're going to have this kind of calamity befall our people if you don't do tshuva? The message of the Nevi'im in the context of pshat, text and context, the speaker and the listener has to be meaningful to the speaker and meaningful to the listener. Otherwise, it's irrelevant. So from that perspective, and here's the yisod, here's the foundation, here's the principle, I'm going to put it out there on the table, and we're going to spend the rest of the class proving it. I do not believe any prophet ever, in any context, articulated a prophecy whose intention was to be a vision of events that would take place 2,500 to 3,000 years into the future. No prophet in any context ever expressed a prophecy whose design was to express the events of history into the long-term reach of hundreds, if not thousands of years. They spoke to their generation and they spoke about events that were meaningful to their generation. And any words, I have to be careful how I say this, but this is very important. Every prophecy of, whether it be a prophecy of Puranut, of potential punishment, or a prophecy of redemption, in the context of Pshat, of what was intended for, was short term. And by short term, we could mean 100 years, we could mean 150 years, but we're not talking thousands of years. So even the prophecies about messianism, what we call messianism, about the seed of David and about the restoration of the kingdom of David or the restoration of the exiles or the restoration of the Beit HaMikdash or the ingathering of the exiles, these were prophecies that were designed to be within grasp, within reach of a generation or two. But for whatever reasons, they failed. And how a prophecy like that can fail, we're going to talk about in today's shiur. And therefore, they get postponed, they get delayed. Because, and this is the second foundation of our understanding of Tanakh, every prophecy, whether good or bad, is automatically implied as conditional. And conditional upon our actions. They portrayed a potential outcome within a short period of time if we do X, Y, or Z, even if they don't state that condition. Now, this has far-reaching ramifications. For example, we have one of the most dramatic prophecies in Tanakh is the last 10 chapters of the book of Yechezkel, in which he describes in detail what the, and you've all heard it, right? What the Beit HaMikdash is going to look like, what the third Beit HaMikdash will look like. He has design plans for the, what we call the third Beit HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem. He has a topographical change of Har HaBayit, of the Temple Mount, in order to accommodate the expanded size of the temple that will be built. He has actual dimensions of what this temple is going to look like. We refer to it as the prophecies of Bayit Shlishi, of the third temple. Newsflash. Yechezkel never says third temple. Yechezkel lives after the destruction of the first temple. He never uses the words for a third temple. It would be meaningless for Yechezkel to be sitting in the Babylonian exile and speak to his people and say, this is the design of a temple that's going to be built 3,000 years from now, after we're going to build another temple in between, and it's going to be destroyed, and then we can build this one. That's absurd. Yechezkel intended for this to be the vision of the temple that would be built when we returned from the Babylonian exile. For whatever reason, it didn't happen. And it didn't happen, it was on us. But because it didn't happen, all of those prophecies get postponed. That's what the Gemara means. It gets nitzuchal dorot. It becomes needed for the future. It becomes preserved for some time in the future when undefined. But the original intent, the context of Yechezkel's words were to speak about an event that would take place within grasp, within reach. And this is not, this may be somewhat revolutionary in terms of how we look at Tanakh, but it's not, it shouldn't surprise anybody. For example, here is, I'm just going to look for the text for a second. I put these in an order that's different from my presentation, so I apologize for that. This is Yechezkel, beginning of Perek Mem, which is the 40th chapter where he begins to describe this temple. And he says, B'25 Shana, Legalutenu Barosh Hashana Basol HaChodesh. This prophecy begins in the 25th year of our captivity. It's about 14 years after the fall of Yerushalayim. And on Rosh Hashanah Basol HaChodesh. Rosh Hashanah Basol HaChodesh means the 10th of Tishrei. Rosh Hashanah is the whole month of Tishrei, and the 10th is Yom Kippur. So it's a prophecy that starts in Yom Kippur of that year. 14 years after Yerushalayim falls, on this day I had a vision. And in this vision I was brought to Yerushalayim. Remember, Yechezkel's in Bavel. He has this vision. He comes to the land of Israel, and he sees a great mountain with a great structure on it. He has a vision of this mikdash. And he sees a person there, a malach, who shows him the kind of a tour guide, if you will. And he speaks to me, and he says, you have been brought here to see this vision and then to express it, to articulate it to the house of Israel. Here's the design, the next 10 chapters, the design of this Mikdash, and you are going to describe it in detail to the Jews in Bavel. So for what purpose? So that they could record it in Tanakh. So 3,000 years ago, when we built the third Beit HaMikdash, the third temple, we could maybe build it upon the design plans of Yechezkel? Or this was a prophecy that was intended to give that generation in Bavel the hope that they could return home and they could build this. That's the hope. Now, ultimately, it didn't happen. But it didn't happen not because the prophecy was intended for 3,000 years from now. It didn't happen because every prophecy is conditional upon the behavior expectations of the people. And if that expectation falls short, then history will take a different direction. And the prophecy gets postponed, delayed, pushed off. Hence, the Gemara says, if it gets needed for generations to come, it'll get recorded. If it didn't take place already, if it's not done, checked off, put in the box, this is now history, right? If it's actually now still an open ticket, so it'll get needed and recorded for posterity, but not because its intention was long-term. Its intention was short-term. This is the theory. And again, it changes every prophecy we read in Tanakh. Because to every nevuah, you now have to ask yourself the question. Every time you read a chapter of Tanakh, you now have to ask yourself a question that's different than what we are used to asking. What we're used to asking is, okay, when in our future is this potentially going to happen? But that's not the relevant question. The relevant question now is the speaker, namely, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Daniel, when they were speaking to a particular audience, what was their intention? What did they have in mind? What were they speaking about? And the assumption that every prophecy is conditional, even prophecies of redemption, conditional upon our behavior immediately, that's quite an astounding assertion. But I think it's true. I think it's absolutely true. And I will show you why it's so profoundly kind of revolutionary. Let's go back to this for a second. I want to start with this Rambam. The problem to everything I'm suggesting to you is that it somewhat flies in the face of a articulated view of prophecy as it's recorded in the Rambam. The Rambam writes the following. When it comes to prophecy, he writes there are two kinds of prophecies. There are good prophecies and there are bad prophecies, meaning there are prophecies of puranut, of calamity, of retribution, of punishment, and there are prophecies of redemption, of promise, of geula, of good, of blessings to come. Divrei puranut shenavi omer kagon shiomar ploni yamut or shaploni or shna ploni ra'av. If a prophet says so and so is going to die, or that so this year is going to be a year of famine or war, prophecies that are negative in nature. If the words of the prophets don't come true, it doesn't deny his prophecy. It doesn't tell me that he's a false prophet, because that the prophet lied to us. Because God is forgiving. And it could be that they did tshuva, and therefore they were forgiven. And the classic example of that is the story of Nineveh and Yonah. Because that's exactly what happens to Yonah. Yonah comes to Nineveh, and he says what is probably the shortest prophecy in the history of Tanakh, five words, od arba'im yom b'Nineveh ne'apachat. In 40 days, Nineveh is going to be destroyed. It's longer in English than it is in Hebrew. Right, five words, and that's it. And guess what? They all do tshuva, and they're all crying, and they're tearing their garments, etc. And God says, okay, I won't do it. I forgive them. And Yonah's crying and he's tearing his garments and he's saying, this is why I didn't want to come in the first place, because I knew that if you would forgive them, I would be left with this five-word prophecy, Nineveh is going to be destroyed. But in the end, it doesn't happen. They're all going to say, I'm a false prophet. But God is forgiving. However, and this is where it gets controversial. If God promised something through prophecy, something good, something positive, the Amar sheyeh kach v'kach, and he said, this is what will be. V'lo ba ha-tova, and the positive prophecy doesn't take place, doesn't happen. Shem b'yadua shu nevi sheker, then you know that he's a false prophet. Shekol dvar tova sheyigzor akel afilo al tnai, any positive statement, any positive prophecy, even if it is conditional, it doesn't fall, it doesn't get nullified, it is permanent. And that's part we learned from the conversation Yirmiyahu has with the false prophets of Hananiah ben Azur, who Hananiah ben Azur was saying that the temple vessels will be returned within 2 years, and Yirmiyahu says to them, I'm telling you, you're going into exile for 70 years, and you're telling me you're coming back in two. So here's the test. If you're right, in 2 years' time, right, all the Kalim are coming back. If they don't come back, then that will prove that you're false prophets, because a false prophecy, a good prophecy has to take place. Whereas if what I'm saying is that you're going into exile, if that doesn't happen, that doesn't disprove that I'm a real prophet, because you could do tshuva. So essentially, Yirmiyahu tells the false prophets of Hananiah ben Azur, halavai, maybe we should all be lucky enough for you to be right and me to be wrong. But the likelihood is not going to happen that way. And so the Rambam learns from that the assumption that a positive statement of redemption of Geula has to take place. It cannot be nullified. On the other hand, and this is really the big issue, Yirmiyahu himself, which is the source of the statement, Yirmiyahu himself makes it very clear that every prophecy is conditional. He writes in Perek Yud Chet the following. Rega daber agoy ve'amamlacha lintosh v'lintotz u'la'avid. One moment I could decree upon a nation that it should be destroyed and uprooted and pulled down. But b'shav agoy ahu mir'ato she'dibarti alav. But if that nation about whom I spoke this calamity does repent and does tshuva, nichamti alara, I could relent and change my mind concerning that punishment. She'cheshavti la'asot lo, says Yirmiyahu. So even the worst calamities prophesied upon any nation, if that nation does tshuva, they can be averted, and the calamity could be averted. That's the famous critique of Noach, that he didn't do anything about the generation of the flood. Says Yirmiyahu in the same breath, in reverse, Rega adaber al goy v'amamlacha limnot v'lintoa. But another moment I could decree about a nation that it should be built or planted or grow, a prophecy of redemption, a prophecy of kingship, a prophecy of return, right? A positive prophecy. But if that nation, if that nation then does evil in my eyes, livel tishma b'koli, not to listen to me, then v'nichamti ala tova, then I will relent even over that good which I promised to do, she'amarti la'ativoto. Says Yirmiyahu, any prophecy, even a good prophecy, even a redemption prophecy, is conditional upon the behavior of the people. Now, this is very problematic, because the Rambam says exactly the opposite, and the Mefarshim struggle with it. They struggle with trying to navigate between the Rambam understanding and Yirmiyahu's understanding. So, for example, the Radak here says that livnot v'linto, when the prophecy refers to building and planting, it means it's already been done. It's already been rebuilt. It's already been replanted, and now they can lose it again. Because otherwise it violates the principle that the Rambam articulates. And that says is essentially a Radak's resolution of the conflict. But if I take a step back from the nuance of this discussion, the Rambam, Yirmiyahu, and the text, at the end of the day, let's just look at it from the perspective of Tanakh. From a Pshat perspective, Yirmiyahu is 1,000% correct. Every prophecy, by definition, is conditional. And that's why you can have the difference between a prophecy like Yonah and Nineveh and a prophecy like Yeshayahu in Nechamit Hayamim is that if it didn't happen because of the people's change of behavior, so in the case of Nineveh, the people did tshuva, okay, that prophecy is buried, it will never happen. In the case of a good prophecy, a prophecy of redemption, if the people do bad and therefore it doesn't happen, it doesn't get canceled, it simply gets pushed off, postponed, reinterpreted, some other meaning, somewhere down, it's called, like, to borrow the expression, kicking the can down the road, it gets pushed down the history line. But its original intention in terms of pshat was local within a generation or two and not beyond. There are many places where this has ramifications in terms of understanding of Tanakh. As you go through now, say, for the Book of Kings, the Book of various prophets, it changes our whole dynamic of how we read Tanakh. And I'll give you a couple of examples, and then we're going to come back to, or one particular example, and then we're going to come back to Yirmiyahu. Daniel. I want to take a look actually at a prophecy, a parak in Sefer Chagai, which is somewhat contemporary, a little bit later than Daniel. Chagai is one of the prophets who lived during the Second Temple period, beginning of the Second Temple. He's referred to in Sefer Ezra when the Jews come back from the Babylonian exile. He's earlier than Ezra. His time period is about the same time as Zerubbabel, who was the governor of Judah under the Persian period when they rebuild the temple. And he is the prophet who kind of accompanies them on this journey to build what we now call the Second Temple. Guarantee you, based on what I'm saying today, that the Jews at the time of building of that Mikdash did not use the words Second Temple, because that would be absurd, right? They certainly didn't refer to second in terms of the third. Right? That would be like the Jews, forgive the analogy and the Havdil, that would be like the First World War. What was the First World War called at the time of the First World War? It wasn't called the First World War. It was called the War to End All Wars, or the Great War. Right? Or the Great War. Can you imagine to suggest that the implication of prophecies is that they're talking about that the Second Temple was understood to be the second out of three is be the equivalent of calling the First World War when the second one hasn't happened yet? Right. That's essentially the analogy. So let's go back to the book of Haggai. I want to show you something very powerful. The book of Haggai, Perek Bet. They're building the second temple, what we call the second temple. They are literally building the temple. And Haggai has the following description. Seventy years after the destruction of the first temple, it's quite possible that there are still Jews alive who returned to the Babylonian exile, who were part of the original exiles who saw the destruction. Anybody 80 years old, 60, 70, 80, no, about 70, 80 years old, would have been alive at the time of the first temple. Actually, this is even earlier. This is several years before the temple was finished. So it's probably about 10 years prior. Right? And he says, who of you were alive? Who's left among you who saw the house in its former splendor? In its former kavod. Remember that word. I'm going to come back to this word kavod. Glory or splendor. What do you see now? You see this as nothing. You see this as insignificant. You see this as a blip. Just to put it in perspective for a second, I'm going to hold here for a second. I just want to show you the equivalent prophecy, the equivalent event in Sefer Ezra. In Ezra, Paragimel, the contemporaries, right? Not Ezra, but Zubavel. They're building the foundation of the temple, Yazdu Abonim et Haichal Hashem, and the Kohanim are standing when they're blasting the trumpets, and the Levites are singing, and they're acknowledging, they're building the temple. This is an extraordinary moment. V'rabim ve'akohanim ve'alevim v'rashei ha'avot azgenim asher ra'u et ha'bayit ha'rishon b'yazdo. But there were many priests and Levites and heads of houses who had seen the first temple, who knew what the first temple looked like. And they saw this temple, bochim, they were crying. Kol gadol. They were crying because they saw this as a travesty. And there were many who were shouting joy and celebrating. It was such a confusion of voices. You couldn't tell who was crying and who was singing because of this confusion. That's exactly what Haggai is describing. Back to Haggai. V'ata says Haggai to the leaders at the time. This is pre-Ezra. Chazak Zerubbabel, be strong, Zerubbabel. Chazak Yeshua ben Yotzadak HaKohen HaGadol, be strong. Yeshua the Kohen Gadol, the Chazak Kol Am Haaretz, and all the people of the land, be strong. Et haDavar shekarati etchem b'tzeitchem in Mitzrayim, b'ruchi amedet b'tochachem, al tirao, I promised you when you came out of Egypt, my spirit is in your midst. Do not fear. Build. Be encouraged. Says Haggai, Komar Hashem Tzvaot, Od achat ma'ati, in just a little bit of time, in just a few bits of history still to come in just a short period of time. I am going to turn an upheaval in heaven and earth, sea and land. I will cause a foundation of all the nations of the world to shake. And all of the precious things of the nations of the world will come here. Umileti et abayit hazeh kavod, and I will fill this house with glory, says God. So much so that what? gadol yiyeh kvod ha'bayit hazeh ha'acharon min harishon. Careful how you translate that verse. The glory of this house. What does acharon here mean? Not second, last.
The next one.
Latter.
The future one.
Latter, meaning in comparison to the Rishon, you have Rishon and Acharon. Rishon and Acharon in this context doesn't mean first and last. It means first and latter. Former and latter. The latter house, in comparison to the former house, Gadol Yekvod HaBayit HaZeh, will be greater in its glory. Now, what does that mean? What is he talking about? So here's how Chazal understood it. And again, Chazal are looking at it in hindsight. Chazal are looking at it from the perspective of, okay, whatever we're dealing with, what does it mean? Says the Yerushalmi in Mestechet Megillah, the Yerushalmi is talking about the chronology of the different temples, first temple and second temple. The first temple stood for 410 years. Ubinyana Acharon, the latter temple, stood for 420 years. We could argue about the chronology. There's a famous issue on the chronology of the Second Temple period, but that's not our subject for today. 410 years, First Temple, 420 years, Second Temple. L'kayem ma she'ne'emar gadol yiyeh kvod ha'bayit hazeh ha'acharon min harishon. To fulfill that which was said, that the covered the glory of the second, of this latter temple will be greater than that of the first. In other words, according to what this Yerushalmi is suggesting, is that Haggai is standing there as they're building the second temple, and the people are crying because they saw the first temple. They knew that the first temple was bigger. They knew that the first temple had the Shekhinah in it. The first temple had the Aron in it. The first temple had the daily miracles in it. The first temple had the what is Kavod? Kavod in the context of a temple usually refers to the Shekhinah, the divine presence, Kavod Hashem. And they're looking at this bayit and they're saying, where's the Kavod? Where's the Shekhinah? There's no ark. There's no divine presence. There's no miracles. The temple is a foundation stone, is nothing in comparison. They're not even building it they even have to ask permission from Persia to build it. They don't even have political sovereignty. The head of the Jewish community is a governor appointed by Persia. His name is Zerubbabel. And Haggai says to them, not to worry, in just a little bit of time, I'm going to make an upheaval that's going to transform this house into a house with more kavod than the first one. What does that mean? Says the Yerushalmi, it means the second temple will stand for 420 years, while the first temple only stood for 410. Is that what it means? Is that really what Haggai had in mind? When he's talking to a people who are crying because they're missing the Aron and missing the Shekhinah and they're missing the fire from heaven, and he's saying to them, not to worry, this empty shell will last 10 years longer than the shell that we had, but than the temple that we had the first time around. Or is that an after-the-fact interpretation because it's a prophecy? It didn't happen. It failed. But a good prophecy, a prophecy of Nevuah, of redemption, can't fail. And so it had to be reinterpreted into some other less significant meaning. But Haggai himself, when he was speaking to the people, he wasn't talking about how long the temple would last. He was talking about how much Shekhinah, how much divine presence would fill this temple. But the second temple never reached the expectation of the prophecies of the prophets. The second temple never achieved that which Haggai had hoped and dreamt about. They never got the Aron back. They never got the Shekhinah to come back to the temple. They never got the infusion of the Shekhinah, of the Kavod that they had of the first temple. And so after the fact, after its destruction, Chazal could look back and say, okay, it lasted 10 years longer. But that was not Haggai's message. And so it's very important as we enter. And if you look at the Mefarshim and that Pasuk, they all jump to this Yerushalmi and say, oh, the Kavod of the second temple was greater because it lasted 10 years longer. So that's not the issue. The issue is much bigger. The issue is, what was the intention of the Navi at the time? The message to the people. They're crying over the absence of the Aron, and you're going to bring them comfort by telling them it's going to last 10 years longer? You're going to bring them comfort because you're going to promise them that if they do the right things, they will restore Jewish sovereignty and they'll restore the kingdom of Israel and they'll restore the Malchus Beis David and they'll restore the Beit HaMikdash to its position as the center of gravity for all of humankind. Yeshayahu's vision. If, big if, they do what they are supposed to do. Whatever happened was a tragedy because Zerubbabel disappears from history and the Second Temple never emerged in the expectation of the, as the prophets envisioned it. This is the foundation. This is the message. Okay. So having placed this thesis on the table, I now come back to the question of questions. Daniel is talking to Nebuchadnezzar and he has a vision and he has a statue. Huge statue made up of multiple metals. And in the statue, he sees a head of gold and he sees a chest and arms of silver and he sees a torso of bronze or copper, whatever metal it is. And he sees legs of iron and clay mixed together. And then he sees a fifth kingdom made of stone that will establish itself forever. Stone that comes out without human hands and will knock down this entire statue and will become a malchut that will be established for eternity. Right? Eternity is essentially as conditional as everything else is in Tanakh. It'll be established for eternity if the people deserve it. It's the basic message, right? This can last forever if you don't mess it up. What is he talking about? So all the Mefarshim, unanimously, up until this point, Rashi, Ibn Ezra, all of the other commentaries, they all see this as a kind of sweep of history. The assumption is that we're talking about a sweep of history that's going to take us all the way to what we call Yomot HaMashiach. So you've got to interpret this story to reach all the way out to 3,000 years into the future. So you have to have Babel, and you have to have Persia, and you have to have Greece, and you have to have Rome, and you have to have Christianity, and you have to have Islam, and you have to have Ishmael, and you have to have every nation that ever stood on the face of the earth. Or, okay, hold on to your horses. Or, Daniel had a short-term prophecy, and his vision is articulated in the book of Daniel for how far into the future the influence of Babel and the kingdoms that he saw and lived through would last. And the theory that I'm suggesting to you is that in the book of Daniel, and we're going to see this play out as we navigate through the text, Daniel's visions never go further than the last nation or empire that he articulates by name. Daniel will name the kingdoms that are coming down the pipeline. But no prophecy in Sefer Daniel will go beyond the nations he identifies by name. Now, if that's true, it changes the whole dynamic of how we read the book. Because it's no longer a book of what 3,000 years into the future. How far into the future is, we'll see in a minute. But let's take a quick glance at how far Daniel's vision in the book, the whole book, how far into the future did he actually see and name and articulate? So we're going to go back to the book of Daniel. And so just a quick review of a little bit of history. Daniel, where am I going to do this? Let's do this here. Daniel sees, Daniel speaks to the king of Babel. In speaking to the king of Babel, he tells the king of Babel that his kingdom is going to fall. In whose hands is the kingdom going to fall? Daniel tells the last king of Babel. Who's the last king of Babel that Daniel communicates with? His name is Belshazzar. The three kings of Babel named in Sefer Daniel are Nebuchadnezzar, Evil Merodach, and Belshazzar. And in the third year of Belshazzar's reign, he has a very famous vision in which he sees a handwriting on the wall. And in that handwriting on the wall, the Pasuk says, actually, it's not in the source page, so I apologize for that. But the Pasuk says that he says to the king of Persia, Mini mini takelu fasin, are the words that are written on the wall. And the word fasin means that your kingdom, he says to the king of Babel, V'yahivat lemadayu paras, will be given to Media and Persia. And that's clear. He says it explicitly in Daniel Parakhet, I'm going to tell you that which will be at the end of the time of indignation. Here's another reference point, right? The end, the acharit. The acharit is not some distant time into the future. It's the appointed time. And at the appointed, these are all terms we use today to refer to Yomot HaMashiach. That's not what Daniel is referring to. He's referring to some vision in which he sees a ram with horns. Ha'ayel asher ha'ita bal kanayim is a reference to Malchei Madayu Parast. This is a reference to the kings of Media and Persia who will conquer Babel. That night in his sleep, the king of Persia is killed by, and Persia conquers Babel. So clearly to the king of Babel, Belshazzar, he speaks specifically about his kingdom falling to the kingdom of Persia. Daniel, in chapter 10, is speaking to Koresh Melech Paras. It's the last king of Persia that Daniel has an actual encounter with. It's the very end of the book. And he says to him, and in this vision, he's having a conversation with a malach. And the angel says to Daniel, Vayomer al tira ish chamudot, don't be afraid, man, loved man, Shalom lach, you will have peace be unto you. Chazak v'chazak b'dabroimi, strengthen me. Vayomer, hayadata lama bati lecha, do you know, says this angel to Daniel, why I've come to you? Yata ashuv li lachem im sar paras. Because it is now my turn to go and fight with the ministering angel of Persia. Ani yotzei v'nei sar yavan ba. And in its place, I will leave, and the prince, the ministering angel of Greece, shall come. Or Daniel Paragidalef, in the days of Dayavesh, also Persia, Media Persia. Vani b'shnat achat Dayavesh Amadi, the first year of the reign of Dayavesh the Mede. Amdila achazikul ma'ozlo, I arose to support and strengthen him. I'll tell you the truth, says Daniel to the king of Persia. There will be another three kings for Persia. We can identify who they are, maybe. Doesn't say who they are. But the fourth king will be far richer than all of them put together. But in his wealth and his strength, and I will add in parentheses, in his arrogance, he will stir up all against the realm of Greece. In other words, Daniel, when he's talking to the king of Babel, talks about the fall of Babel in the hands of Persia. When he's talking to the kings of Persia, he talks about the fall of Persia in the hands of Greece. The last king that Daniel speaks to is the king of Persia. Daniel foresees and names, articulates the kings of Greece as a conquest, as a conflict with Persia. He names Babel, he names Paras Umadai, he names Yavan. Those are the only nations in the future that Daniel names. And so what I'm suggesting to you is that Daniel's vision from a pshat perspective never goes further in time than Alexander the Great, or just subsequent to Alexander the Great. The last period of history that Daniel will look at analyze and describe in his prophecies are the stories of Greece. Now, if that's true, and that's because, right, and he names them, then if I go back to the vision of Daniel's, of Nebuchadnezzar's statue, so let's go back to what he's telling Nebuchadnezzar. What he's telling Nebuchadnezzar is, you are the gold head. Your kingdom is numbered in days. It will be conquered by Persia and Media, the combined kingdoms, the right hand and the left hand of silver, which will eventually be conquered by another kingdom of brass or copper or bronze, Nechoshet. And that Nechoshet refers to whom? If this is kingdoms along the journey, who is the Nechoshet? Greece. But what about the iron legs? What about the iron and the clay split of the two kingdoms, of the legs? So we will explore this in much more detail in the latter chapters. But the theory is, if you're looking for a kingdom that splits apart, you don't need to go to Rome to find a kingdom that splits apart. You only need to go to the second generation of the kings of Greece. Because what happened to the Greek Empire after Alexander the Great? In the Great War of the Successors, known as, and I don't know how to pronounce this because it's pronounced differently in different places, and anyway, the academics are welcome to jump in, but the Diadochi or the Diadochi or the I've seen it pronounced in different places, right? But the Greek word for the successors, the great battles that led to the conflict between the Ptolemy dynasties and the Seleucid dynasties and the split apart of the Greek Empire, the greatest empire the world ever saw, the greatest conquest the world ever saw, was totally decimated because the kings, the generals who succeeded Alexander the Great were warring with each other. That's exactly the legs split apart and the clay and the iron that can't mix in the fight and the conflict and that eventually leads to what? That eventually leads to the great stone hewn out of the, not by human hands, that will come and knock it all down and build the kingdom that will eventually be loyal to God, the kingdom that God builds, the kingdom that will endure, here's the key phrase, forever, provided that. Remember, every prophecy is conditional. So what is he referring to? In that fifth kingdom of the rock that will destroy this great conflict between the Diadochi battles. So here's the final theory I'm going to share with you. And that is that the final step that he saw, where this rock would establish Malchut Shemayim, Malchut Hashem, is a reference to the battle of the Chashmonaim to liberate the land of Israel from the hands of the Greeks. And the furthest most event that Daniel foresaw in his visions was the story of Hanukkah. And the references directly to it that we'll see at the end of the book. That's the Malchut Hashem that will emerge and destroy the influence of the Greek Empire in the land of Israel. Now, how far afield would it go would depend totally on the Jewish people. Right? In other words, it fails. Post Hanukkah, the kingdom of the Chashmonaim is a terrible failure. Daniel doesn't see that because he doesn't see that far afield. What he sees is the potential. And the potential of the events of Hanukkah, the potential to create an upheaval that will re-emerge as the great temple of Israel and the kingdom of Israel that will emerge back onto the world stage. The potential was all there. Daniel only saw its potential. Now, Daniel is not the only one to see it this way. The other person who saw the potential of the events of Hanukkah to transform the temple into its great vision of that that moment of messianic proportion was that same Navi Haggai that we just looked at. Let's go back to that prophecy in Haggai for a second. Haggai, beginning of the Second Temple, they're laying the foundation stone. This is long before. They're still in the Persian rule. Right? That's part of the problem, is that they're being told they have to, Zerubbabel is a governor of Persia. And he says to them, you see a temple under foreign subjugation. You see a temple controlled by a foreign power. You see a temple without an ark. You see a temple without a power pack. Well, you see a temple without the kavod, without the shechina. On the chad ma'ati, just wait, just a little bit of time. Vani ma'ish et ha-shamayim ba'aretz. You know what a rash is in Tanakh? A rash is an earthquake. I'm going to cause an earthquake. That's going to be an upheaval of nations. Now look at Pasuk Chaf, the end of this parak. And more El Zerubbabel Pachat Yudah, speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah appointed by Persia, and say to him, I'm going to cause an upheaval in heaven and earth. I will overturn kingdoms. And overturn chariots and kingdoms. I will transform every army and every military tool there is in the book. And on that day, I will take you, Zerubbabel, my descendant from David HaMelech, Zerubbabel ben Shaltiel, you, my servant, who are now just a lowly servant of Persia. V'samticha kachotam, I will turn you into a king with a signet ring. I, says God, will make you a king. Now the restoration of Beit David, the restoration of the seed of David on the throne of Israel. Yibacha bacharti, I've chosen you, says Haggai to Zerubbabel. When is all this supposed to happen? Watch this. Ready for this? Let's go into Rashi. Oh, the chad ma'ati, just a little bit of time. When this Persian empire that is ruling over you will fall, one more nation will come to reign over you and to cause you distress, namely Machut Yavan. That's Greece. But its lasting time will be very short. But ani ma'ish, I will cause an upheaval, nations upheaval, enemies upheaval, armies upheaval. I will reestablish Malchut Yisrael. When? B'nisim asim l'imei Chashmonai, says Rashi. In the days of the Chashmonaim and the great miracles of Hanukkah. And then everybody will understand, Sheshchinati Shereh B'Bayit Hazeh, that my presence, my divine presence rests in this house. That's the great Shechina that will return to the temple at the time of the great victory over Greece. We only have one victory over Greece. It's called Chanukah. In other words, what Daniel saw, what Haggai saw, were potential for a restoration of Malchut Yisrael and the restoration of the temple and the restoration of the kingdom of Israel and all of the great messianic prophecies, like every prophet before him who saw potential moments in history, if we don't squander it. Unfortunately, in the case of Hanukkah, we squandered it. In the case of Beit Sheni, the whole Second Temple period was one opportunity squandered after another. But the vision that Daniel saw was the potential. And the potential was for Greece to be the last empire to rule over us and to us to restore Jewish sovereignty to the land of Israel and the Shekhinah, the divine presence, to the temple itself. And since we are a week before Hanukkah, I will leave you with the following observation. I meant for this to be kind of a pre-Hanukkah shiur, so it actually worked out very nicely, which is that one of the great stories of Hanukkah is the miracle of the oil. The miracle of the oil is a miracle of fire. What is the manifestation of the Shekhinah in the temple itself?
Smoke.
smoke or fire. In other words, that's exactly what the story of Hanukkah was. It was the spark of the kavod of the Shekhinah that Haggai spoke about. The only question is it a spark that then gets ignites into a fire and then explodes into a flame of an anea kavod and the Shekhinah and an eishochla and the rest of, and the kingdom of Israel? Or is it a spark that then goes out? That will depend on us. Like every other prophecy in history, that depends on us. And so my takeaway from this whole story is that Daniel is talking about events in history that he saw within grasp, within reach, within a century. And a political insight inspired by this prophecy. But how it gets interpreted, unfortunately, we will squander that opportunity. So then over the course of history, it gets reinterpreted into other events and other things. But Daniel himself, and in order to process this through the rest of the book, it means we're going to have to recalculate every time Daniel talks about numbers. Daniel is the only prophecy, only book in all of Tanakh that puts numbers, when this will happen, and he puts numbers, so-and-so number of hundreds of days or thousands of days or numbers of weeks. And those prophecies, those numbers have been used to support every prophetic, messianic calculation in the course of history. So we're going to have to reread all those numbers because this theory essentially takes a different twist to in a different way of looking at the book of Daniel. And that ends really our first unit, if you will, in terms of chapter 1 and 2. Bezrat Hashem, next week we will have a class and we'll begin a study of chapter 3 and we'll continue from there. And thank you for listening. And I'm happy to stay online if people have questions, but officially it is now 1:04. So I have gone 4 minutes over. But thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi.
My pleasure.
It was thank
fantastic,
you.
Inspired, riveting.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. Absolutely fascinating.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you.
Rabbi Shulman, and look out for our Hanukkah classes in the next couple days.
Of which one you just had.
Have a great week.
You too, everybody. Signing off. Have a great day.